Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 24th of May, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, and myself, Brian Gerrish. What's it to be, Novichok?
Absolutely. So we asked the question, where are the Skripals? And, well,
they pop up.
They pop up. But certainly Julia pops up. Here she is giving her statement. Statement given to Reuters. She wasn't allowed to answer any questions, and it was clearly a statement that she was reading. She is looking quite healthy, Brian. But it all seems a bit fishy to me. Looking at some of the comments about this online, people saying, well, she doesn't look under pressure. But the fact of the matter is that she didn't seem to be able to speak from her own mind, as it were. She had words that she was expected to read. And as I say, she wasn't allowed to answer any questions. So this woman is not a free woman.
It's incredible, Mike. I've got to come back to the whole circumstance of what we were led to believe by the British government. So if we just recap, we are led to believe that a pure weapons grade chemical nerve agent, Novichok, was put on the door handle of their home. So Yulia and her father touch that handle, or one touches it and then the other touches the other person and cross-contaminates. It's weapons grade, it's pure, but they then go to the pub and have a drink. And after they've had a drink, they go to a restaurant and they spend at least a couple of hours in a restaurant. And then it's only afterwards that the effect of this weapons grade Novichok takes effect. It cross-contaminates a policeman, we're led to believe. Medical services arrive, they're all taken to the hospital. Presumably at that stage, nobody in the hospital knows what they're really dealing with. So any members of staff that touch them, got bodily fluids on their hands, would have been cross-contaminated. But surprisingly, just these three people, the Skripals and the policeman, are supposedly contaminated. And despite it being pure military-grade nerve agent Novichok, which the government says, none of them die. And then I'm just going to have to say, but of course, Public Health England in UK posted on its web page that if you were worried as a member of the public, you might have come into contact with some of the residue of this weapons grade Novichok, then make sure you wash your hands, get your clothes washed and use, quote, baby wipes. Mike, this story is untenable. And whatever took place, something is not right, because if this is the quality of a Russian military grade nerve agent, of course, they'd be the laughing stock of the world. So I don't believe this story at all. And I've got to say, it's remarkable that she's appeared in public with the scar on her throat, which leads us to believe that she's actually needed help to breathe at some stage, which would reinforce that she's been poisoned by something, but whatever it was hasn't killed her.
Well, I'll just we'll just mention that because, of course, the tracheotomy scar has been nicely framed by the blouse that she's chosen to wear.
Yep.
Purely coincidental, I'm sure.
Well, we could say, possibly, some would say, leave it open to the air. Don't let any material rub it. So I could think of a medical reason for that, but yes, it seems amazing that she's come into public with that area nicely framed.
And the other thing that she said in her statement was that she was hoping to return to Russia at some point in the future. Now, people that are commenting on this online are suggesting that her words were very carefully chosen because she didn't blame Russia for the alleged attack on her and her father. She didn't deny it was Russia either, so she didn't make any comment on that. But she did say that she hopes to return to Russia at some point in the future. And what was not clear to me was whether she meant that there was some risk in her returning to Russia because it was the Russians that had carried out this alleged attack, or because, in fact, she was wondering about when she was ever going to be released out of British custody.
Yeah.
We'll come on to that in a second. What's the Russians' response been to this? Well, Dmitry Peskov, who's Putin's spokesperson, said, we cannot be completely sure about her condition, whether she's under pressure, whether she actually made any statement, and if so, whether she made it on her, of her own accord. This is a fair point, and I'm just going to put this up again because, okay, she's now appeared on camera. She's now made a prepared statement, but the question is remains, where are the Skripals? We don't know. They're in British custody somewhere, anonymously. Until she makes a free statement or something which is quite clearly a free statement, then that question remains.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the meantime, Stephen Halper, we mentioned this yesterday, the so-called Spygate scandal in the United States. I noticed that there's very little British mainstream media coverage of this story at all. Only the Telegraph seems to have covered this. But this is the Wall Street Journal here. But multiple US media sources now confirming that the American academic Stephen Halper is the top secret, the so-called top secret informant that the FBI had asked to get involved with the Trump campaign in 2016. The questions that the mainstream media in the States are asking is who asked Halper to keep tabs on Trump officials, when did he get involved and why? And of course, this goes right back to the FBI's claim that it didn't open an official counterintelligence probe into so-called Trump-Russia collusion in 2016. Now, this also links back to Carter Page, as the Wall Street Journal is pointing out here. It says that Carter Page said that he met Halper in mid-July 2016 at a symposium in Cambridge University, where Halper at the time is an emeritus professor. Page said that the invitation to that event came much earlier in May or June of that year, and the event was supported by Cambridge's Department of Politics and International Studies. So there seems to be implications that this runs back to Cambridge itself. And also participating at that meeting was Richard Dearlove. So this becomes very murky. And then the American Spectator, in this article entitled John Brennan's Plot to Infiltrate the Trump Campaign, is saying that this is part of John Brennan's interagency task force set up in mid-2016, again, to look at allegations of that Putin was putting money into the Trump campaign. And they are also, this article is bringing to light or reminding everybody that before and after the FBI began its probe, that John Brennan was, quotes, bringing together into the same room at CIA headquarters a cast of Trump haters across the Obama administration whose activities he could direct. That included Peter Strzok, who was the FBI liaison to Brennan, and Jim Clapper, and an assortment of Brennan's buddies at the Treasury Department, Justice Department, and the White House. And they go on to say that that they had access to Stephen Halper's file, that they sized him up as the perfect candidate to become their spy within the White House, that Halper came out of the brainstorming of Brennan's group is clear from the fact that that his first known meeting with Carter Page preceded the formal opening of the FBI probe. So this situation gets dirtier and dirtier. And as we said yesterday, the comments are that all roads lead back to Britain. And this is the foundation of what became the Russiagate probe. So it's all unraveling very quickly.
And lots of questions still to be asked and answered on it. So if we stay in Britain for the moment, at least, and let's put this image on screen. I asked a couple of people earlier today what they thought of this image. I didn't give them any context to it. Admittedly, the two people that I asked were both male, and they said, well, it's a little bit of a come on smile. It's a good looking young lady.
But what age is she?
We don't know what age. There was a bit of a debate about that. What age is she? She could be really quite young, maybe 17, but on the other hand, you could say that she could be older. Be interesting to know what a lady would say looking at this picture. But we just had that little loose discussion just to get a feel for really what it was. Well, what was it? It was actually part of this, which is the advert for BBC Two's Manchester, The Night of the Bomb documentary. And I just found this extraordinary, that a documentary on a very, very sensitive issue, if we take the story as we've been told, where people have been killed and maimed, we started off with what I'm going to say, slightly sexy image. Mm. But this is how the BBC approached it. We did a little bit of work on this, and we're going to ask our audience for help in digging deeper. Let's see how this story unfolded. Well, we decided to take the Mail report here. It says Manchester Police Chief condemns inappropriate and inaccurate BBC documentary that showed graphic scenes of terror attack aftermath and claimed officers were prevented from helping the victims. Now, I am going to admit at this stage, I have not personally seen this documentary. I will be watching it. But I've just taken the press reports and I've done some basic investigation. But one of the things that we can see the police are complaining about is that apparently in the documentary, they are being accused of arriving late and therefore not providing the service. And the same accusation is labelled against the ambulance service, whereas British Transport Police are actually praised for their work in saving the wounded, the injured. So let's see what the Chief Constable Ian Hopkins had to say. He says, this documentary, in our view, is entirely inappropriate, and I deeply regret the impact the actions of the production company and the BBC may have on those who matter most, the victims, families and survivors of one of the worst terrorist attacks this country has ever seen. It's clear this man's motivated, Mike, but I'm going to say at this point, at least he is stood up to be counted. He's talking to the press using his real name and real identity. He goes on, he says, I wrote the letter to explain why my force did not take part in the programme and correct its inaccurate reporting. At no point were Greater Manchester police officers and staff held back, and they were immediately deployed to the arena to save life and protect people. I have to put in a qualifier there. When he says they were immediately deployed, presumably that was after the police were informed there'd been an incident. He goes on, he says, this documentary, in our view, failed to accurately depict the events of the night and is a partial reconstruction at best. The production company, no doubt, will say that organisations were offered the chance to cooperate and they chose not to. But these very organisations have an overriding duty to families and the courts and so cannot cooperate with a production company whose only aim is to provide newsworthy viewing at the expense of the families, coronial process and indeed a criminal trial. So the main thrust of Mr. Ian Hopkins here is that he couldn't talk to this company because of the criminal investigations and processes that were still ongoing.
But clearly concerned about bias as well.
And he was very concerned about bias. So he stands up. He is a real man, obviously. He's named, he speaks. Let's have a look at what the BBC had to say. And of course, the BBC is anonymous. Nobody's linked to this, but apparently the BBC said the production company worked constructively and appropriately with victim support, and the sensitivities of all those involved in this tragic event were subject to careful consideration throughout the production process. This was a responsible, accurate and thoughtful documentary, which was an important piece of public service broadcasting. And of course, that is an anonymous statement by the BBC. We have no idea who made that. And this got me rather curious as to how this whole thing had been put together. And of course, a couple of days ago, Mike, you pointed out that when you asked the BBC about its internal organisational structure, they said they didn't actually have any form of organisational structure to cover, which was the particular...
That was BBC Trending.
BBC Trending. So we got a little picture of a little bit of chaos maybe inside the BBC. But we think this man was responsible. So here he is. This is Patrick Holland, who's now the head of documentaries commissioning for BBC Two. This appears to be the most likely man responsible for setting up this documentary. And he says this, or he did when he came into post, "It's a huge privilege to be channel editor of BBC Two. BBC Two is a unique channel, combining wit and warmth with an unrivaled sense of inquiry and intelligence. More than ever, BBC Two needs to be a place that champions creativity and enables authorship. I'm really looking forward to working with Charlotte," that's his number two, "and the team to build on the channel's great state of programmes and shape the next stage of its evolution." So lots of BBC speak there. But what was really taking place? Well, let's see who was actually producing this documentary. And the first name that the BBC provides is this gentleman, Dan Reed. So here is his Twitter page. It's very dark, Mike. He says, "Inspiration will come, but it has to find you at work." What can we find on his Twitter page? Well, there's some very interesting information. He retweets a lady called Katie in bits after watching Manchester the night of the bomb. "The survivors are so brave talking about that horrific night. When that girl started talking about washing human flesh out of her hair, powerful film." So we're getting some indication of the seriousness of the film. This just happens to be another tweet. "It's back, the BBC. It was a disaster compounded by disastrous leadership of the Manchester Ambulance Service, Police and Fire Brigade on the night." So here is the BBC absolutely hammering the emergency services. The police are saying, well, hang on a minute, we can't defend ourselves because of the legal situation. So let's go to the next man involved. This is the Night of the Bomb director, Jamie Roberts. Encourage people to go and have a look at his Twitter page. He's a very interesting man. What sort of thing has he been retweeting? Well, he's got this one, "News from Amnesty, Syria War 2016, deadliest year for children, says UNICEF." And of course, this is promoting the BBC's own, we're going to say, lackluster reporting over the war in Syria. We've got this one here. So this is War Child, trailer for the film I've been making, groundbreaking, says UNICEF. So this man is clearly highly political, as we can see by the tweets. He's not just an ordinary filmmaker, and he's got some interesting connections. Huffington Post get a retweet. "Real lives are defined and sometimes destroyed by oafishly ignorant voices." This is a Channel 4 documentary. Of course, it's the Huffington Post that's been sniping at Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire, because Patrick's been reporting something other than them on the situation in Syria. But let's look at the meat of it. So here's Jamie Roberts. And what are we going to bring in? Well, this is a quote from Radio Times. "Filmmaker Jamie Roberts has a history of producing searing documentaries. He's embedded himself with people from all walks of life, from members of the far right for Angry, White and Proud, to child refugees for War Child. His extraordinary film, The Jihadis Next Door, for which he spent 2 years with Islamic extremists in the UK, made headlines last year when one of the men it featured went on to wreak terror in London Bridge and another travelled to Syria to join the Islamic State." That's a pretty amazing coincidence, isn't it, that he gets out on the streets interviewing people for The Jihadis Next Door, and one of them is involved in a serious incident. I find that just a remarkable coincidence. We've got this. Where are we? "When the BBC decided to make a film about the suicide bombing at the Arani Grand Concert in Manchester on the 22nd of May 2017, Jamie Roberts is the man they called. Exactly 10 days after Salman Abidi blew himself up with a nuts and bolts bomb, killing 22 and injuring more than 100, Manchester, the Night of the Bomb, was officially in production." So remarkable, Mike, that the BBC was on the case 10 days after the event had happened. And let's bring in a bit more. "This was not Robert's first experience of establishing trust with interviewers who fiercely value their anonymity. In The Jihadis Next Door, he spent 2 years filming Islamic extremists. And then there was those incidents came up. So this man, highly political, sorry, I should get another image on screen here. What's he going to be doing next? Grenfell Tower. So I don't quite understand how this works. This is the editor of the film itself, Christopher Swain. You can have a look at some of his details on the internet. Of course, he's got a background with the BBC. And when we look at the film company itself, Amos Pictures, I do not understand how a one-man production company is suddenly entrusted to do a documentary on such a serious subject. BBC stands back and said, well, it was us, so you can trust us.
Anonymously.
Yes. If anybody can establish any more information about how this BBC documentary has been put together, certainly we're going to be watching it. Perhaps you'd like to email us or give us a call.
Okay, Media on Trial taking place on Sunday in Leeds. Details at mediaontrial.uk. Apparently they spoke to the venue last night and that they've allowed Media on Trial to sell a few more tickets because there is still demand for tickets. So that I believe there are 17 tickets left now as of lunchtime today. So if you want a ticket, there are still a few. Get onto that. I also understand from Sheila that there will be communications going out today about how details of the venue will be communicated. But for anybody that's waiting for details of the venue, my understanding is that that will not go out until Saturday. And that is in order to protect the event and to protect the venue. So details of that will go out to all ticket holders on Saturday, and there'll be communications before then to explain the process. Now, tonight, Ian Crane is in the studio, 7:30 for Humanity versus Insanity. We'll have Dr. Graham Downing on and discussing the massive increase in deaths across England and Wales in the first part of 2018. We covered this on the UK Column News last week, but Graham will have a lot more details on that. So the 7:30 this evening on ukcolumn.org/live. And then at 9 o'clock, things moving so quickly that Ian has decided to do a fracking nightmare. And he's saying here that Quadrilla have submitted their request to Greg Clark to frack the first horizontal unconventional gas well at Preston New Road near Blackpool, whilst applying to the courts to prevent any protest action which might cause a delay or cost. In the meantime, the Environment Agency has introduced water control measures, and also Professor Peter Stiles, former advisor to David Cameron, has issued a report suggesting that fracking beneath the old coal mines in northern England will cause significant seismic activity, including property damage and contamination. So that's at 9 o'clock. You can get onto that at ukcolumn.org/live. Now, the front page of the Daily Mail today was very interesting. Brian, plot to subvert Brexit exposed, and perhaps the Daily Mail still has some little ability to provide some investigative journalism after all. But they're talking about George Soros and what's a mostly £6 million campaign fund. This is a leaked dossier that they've discovered, and it's to do with the campaign group Best for Britain, backed by George Soros. And they're saying that leaked papers apparently show that a pro-Remain group has launched a six-month plan to stop Britain leaving the EU, backed by George Soros. Best for Britain aims to spend this amount of money, according to the documents. They allegedly reveal that a group will contradict whatever final agreement Theresa May strikes with Brussels, arguing that it's not what we voted for. They say that the 26-page plan reveals that Best for Britain will claim leaving the EU will put national security at risk. Remain activists will blame Brexit for funding cuts in local councils. They will also claim that Leave voters were rejecting Westminster and not Brussels. So they will start sending documentation to potential donors apparently over the next few days. And that's all very good. George Soros once again getting involved in the internal politics of another country.
Using propaganda.
Absolutely.
Using propaganda. And I think that's a wonderful introduction to say that David Barnby produced an extremely good book talking about how propaganda was used to get us into the common market in the first place. Secret meetings in government, slush funds, money from Europe coming into Britain to run up teams of people writing letters to the paper, to papers pro-Europe, as if they were ordinary members of the community. And that book by Dave Barmby is well worth a read. We'll promote it again, because I think reading it with hindsight of events in this Brexit smokescreen, and probably reading this report from the Daily Mail, will give it more legs. The book is called The EU, A Corporatist Racket.
Right. Well, let's talk about the EU, because the EU is holding, the Eurogroup is holding a meeting today, and the Eurogroup meeting will take place two formats. Apparently, the first part will be a regular meeting of the Eurozone ministers starting at 3 o'clock this afternoon. And the second part will be a meeting of the EU 27 member states. That's everybody except the UK. And that starts at 5:30 this evening. And it's the 5:30 this evening meeting that I'm interested in, because this is all about banking union and the European Stability Mechanism. So finance ministers from 27 EU member states will have another round of discussions on the completion of the banking union and the future role of the European Stability Mechanism. And they'll take stock of progress made so far and will exchange views on the way forward. Now, this is important because if you remember going back to, I think, to September, October last year, Donald Tusk was threatening EU member states. Of course, Donald Tusk is the president of the European Council. He was threatening EU member states that he would do everything in his power to take the first concrete steps by June of 2018 towards establishing a European Monetary Fund and the strengthening and stability of the banking union. So this is all about the European Stability Mechanism and the banking union. And at that time, he said that any member state that got in his way, mind you, not in their way, in his way, would be named and shamed, and he would do his best to embarrass them if there was any delay to this drive towards banking union by June this year. Well, unfortunately for Donald Tusk and perhaps some others, the EU is expected to miss this June deadline for banking union. There has been some progress, but there's probably not going to be enough progress to satisfy Donald Tusk. Consensus may be reached on assigning a so-called backstop role to the European Stability Mechanism to deal with the largest banks should they run into trouble, but they don't expect to be able to get as far as full banking union by then, which is a crying shame, isn't it?
It is, but we'll remind viewers and listeners that banking union allows the formal EU military unification to go ahead, and that military unification is proceeding rapidly. We will be reporting more on that next week. Well, just taking a little look inside Westminster. Does Westminster work as we think it does? Does it work as the MPs think it works? We don't think so. And thank you very much to the gentleman who gave us a call this morning to say you should have a look at the policy research unit. So here it is on screen. This is a shot of their website, a not-for-profit pooled research facility offering efficiency savings and subject expertise to MPs. Our model cuts out duplication of effort in Parliament and allows our researchers to specialise in particular policy areas. You can read more about how we help MPs with their parliamentary duties here. But it is a subscriber login. Note that it's linked up with the Social Mobility Foundation, apprenticeships and living wage. But we did manage to get a little bit further. So let's bring this bit in. And here it says that it's a non-profit making pooled research facility based in the Houses of Parliament and open to Conservative MPs to join. So you've got to be a Conservative MP.
Oh, so it's not all MPs then?
Not all MPs. It was established in 1998, provides briefing, research, correspondence and related support for MPs exclusively in support of their parliamentary duties. The PRU is independent of any political party. I had trouble with this, Mike, because you've got to be a Conservative MP to use it, but it's independent of any political party.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
This is clearly the Westminster definition of independence. We've mentioned this several times before, but...
You put we're independent because that puts most people off straight away. So we're independent. You needn't look any further. We're independent, but we're not. We're really political. We're a political research group for the Tory party. Worth going and having a look at trustees, because then we get in some very interesting personalities. We've got Liz Astle, former managing, sorry, this is social, I beg your pardon, I've jumped onto social mobility that they're linked in with. We've got Liz Astle, formerly managing director of Accenture, Hazel Blears, we've got Nick Clegg, it's all looking good so far. We've got Sir Victor Blank, leading UK businessman and former UK business ambassador. He's big in banking and media, so that's okay. And Doherty, JP Morgan. So these are all upstanding people in the big business.
So I presume the Social Mobility Foundation is pumping money into this organisation, the PRU?
Well, what they're actually doing is providing the young people, Mike. So we've got big business selecting young people who normally wouldn't get on in the world. They're saying, you're just the sort of person we need. We're going to get you through to become a parliamentary researcher. And then what I suspect happens is that those young parliamentary researchers are screened again and then selected to be parliamentary candidates.
Right.
That's what I think is going on. We'll just take you through to apprenticeships because all this is tied in with the government programme itself. So this is a bit of a incestuous relationship. And this one made me smile because when you went to the Living Wage, they say what it is by presenting a cartoon that a few good people said it would be right if we had a living wage you can just about live on. Mm. And then they started a movement and the next minute that became very big. So what's going on inside Parliament? I think they're grooming their own candidates. You're not going to take members of the public. You're only going to be selected for the political party if you've already worked in it.
Mm. Okay, well, Gavin Williamson, our fantastic Secretary of State for War, was speaking at Roosie this morning. He was speaking at the first Sea Lords Sea Power Conference 2018. And this conference Roosie is running is examining the opportunities and challenges involved in human-machine combat teaming for naval warfare in the future. The conference is addressing the potential for human-machine combat teaming, implications for force design, disinvestment strategies, and people from the year 2035. The emergence of autonomous and remotely controlled systems and mature weapon systems has taken a half century to arrive, but there are signs that by 2035, such systems will be able to mitigate for scale and mass in warfare. Adversaries are also harnessing these systems to a democratization of weapons and the sensors seems likely, and so it goes on. Now, what was Gavin Williamson saying? Well, he was certainly making a point about European defence. He says, as we leave the European Union, you will not find the UK retreating to its shores. Instead, you'll find us seeking to expand our friendships. So that's fantastic stuff. But really, he was there. He began his speech by, saying what a great sea power Britain is, that we have this amazing navy, that it's fit for purpose and all this kind of stuff. And I just thought I would contrast that with the reality, which is quite the opposite, and particularly what the World Economic Forum is saying about the Chinese and how its military is, how its navy is developing. So this headline on this World Economic Forum article here is how China is becoming a naval superpower and why that matters. And it says, in early April 2018, Chinese media released footage of a Type 52D destroyer of the People's Liberation Army Navy sailing in the South China Sea. And they say that whilst the fleet review did not produce much in the way of technical revelations, it drove home in a rather vivid way the dramatic progress that the Chinese Navy, that its modernization has done in recent years, and the significant operational potential that this fleet now represents. And they say that during the 1990s and 2000s, Chinese naval shipyards produced large range of different vessel types, many of which were improvements on their predecessors. Recent construction has largely settled on a few designs and focused on a series production of them in large numbers. And they start talking about the numbers and so on, and they produce this handy graph. And the point that they're making here is that since 2014, so that's only in a few years, since 2014, the Chinese have built roughly the same number of ships, new ships, that the Japanese have in their entire fleet, going back how many days? I mean, I don't know. What is the life scale of a typical naval vessel, Brian?
Well,
30 years?
Yeah, 25, 30 years.
So in you know, 5 years or something, they have produced the same number that Japan has in their entire navy, the same number that Britain has in its entire navy, and significantly more than many other countries. So you know, they've got other ships other than the ones that they've built in the last few years. And really, the World Economic Forum saying that China's advances so far have shifted the balance in terms of its ability to exert influence in a regional context, even if it may still form short in terms of full high-end capability against a top-tier navy. But Britain doesn't have a top-tier navy anymore.
Well, I'm afraid to say it doesn't. Mike, and it's time that the Defence Secretary started to tell his Defence Select Committee the truth.
Yeah, or Rusi for that matter, because he was implying something different. And it may not be too long before, as well as assembling an impressive armada in the South China Sea, China's investments in naval capability will see it able to deploy really quite significant task groups of ships further afield as well. And let's not leave it at the Navy, because China... as Zero Hedge is pointing out here, Beijing warns new stealth fighters will conduct patrols in Taiwan's airspace. And this is China's fifth generation stealth fighter, the J-20. It's the equivalent of the F-35. But it seems to be flying, and it seems to be ready for deployment.
That's probably because the Chinese built it and they're going to maintain it, and that keeps things very simple as opposed to this conglomerate idea with the F-35.
Well, absolutely. Now, I did look at what the profession felt the relative capabilities of the F-35 and the J-20 were, and they say that the J-20 doesn't have quite as good sensors, and they say that it doesn't have quite as good armaments and so on. But the fact is, it's flying, and the F-35 isn't. I believe it's not trying to kill its pilots, and the F-35 is.
By shutting off oxygen.
Oxygen, yes, yeah. Exactly. So, you know, the question is, the F-35 to me seems like that they are trying to drive forward towards this goal of autonomous weaponry, yeah. And that they're putting levels of sophistication into it, which they don't really... we don't have the capability for just yet. They're rushing too far ahead. Do you disagree with that?
No, don't disagree with that.
Okay. National Health Service, Brian. At the NHS conference that we ran a couple of weeks ago, various presentations from various people, and one of the key themes that came through it all was how was the NHS going to be funded, continuing privatisation and so on. This article from the Institute of Fiscal Studies, or this report, sorry, from the Institute for Fiscal Studies, Securing the Future, Funding Health and Social Care in the 2030s, is basically echoing many of the points that were made at the conference. They're saying that the NHS is going to need an extra £2,000 a year per household in order to continue to function properly. And they said that there was no more room to increase health spending by taking from other government budgets. And the taxes will have to rise. Now, one of the points that was made at the conference, as many people will know, is that they're trying to get us to think about the NHS in terms of a subscription on top of whatever we pay in terms of our taxes, a monthly subscription, of perhaps starting with £10 a month per person, but that would likely just be the thin end of the wedge. And as time goes on, that £10 a month would increase. That's one option. But the other option that's being promoted very heavily at the moment is that we have a separate health-related insurance scheme that we all have to pay in.
So ultimately the NHS would really become a health insurance provider.
Absolutely, rather than a health care provider. And that certainly seems to be echoed in this report from the Institute for Fiscal Studies.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I picked up on this as well. I came in a slightly different angle. This was a screenshot, the BBC's news webpage. I found it remarkable. Top left, we've got one NHS article, tax rises needed to prevent NHS misery. So that's a pretty typical BBC headline. We've got five articles on abortion. BBC simply pumping out the government line. There's no analysis. But when we can get into another country and stir up angst, which of course is the abortion issue in Ireland, then they are all guns blazing. But we're not really interested in the NHS and health, because the Daily Mail is bigging up on the fact that we should be paying attention, because Channel 4 tonight is going to be advertising Viagra. This is the big event for the British nation. Never mind problems with the NHS, never mind the homeless. We should be very excited because one of the big pharma companies, Pfizer, is now going to be advertising for Viagra. And the Mail and others are very pleased to be helping it.
And this is the first time Viagra has been advertised on British television.
Yeah, and apparently there's this very exciting little video where the man is so pleased he's dancing around the house after the event. So this is really important stuff. This is the state of Britain in 2018. But of course, what won't they be telling you? What they're not going to be talking about is side effects of this drug. So we had a little look at the Viagra side effects page here. This is Pfizer's page. It says that if you end up with an erection that won't go away, you should seek medical help. If you should get sudden vision loss in one or both eyes, or sudden hearing decrease or hearing loss. So these are not, you know, symptoms that come on slowly. These are things you're going to experience and you've got a major problem. But it goes on. Let's have a look at other things. Headache, flushing, upset stomach, abnormal vision, stuffy or runny nose, back pain, muscle pain, nausea, dizziness, rash. And if that isn't enough, we can continue here. It says, in addition, heart attack, stroke, irregular heartbeat and death have happened rarely, in men taking Viagra. I love the structure of that sentence. It's a risk, but it's rare.
It's rare.
It's not really a problem unless it happens.
I can see how all these things would be mood killers, Brian.
Yeah. Most but not all of these men had heart problems before taking Viagra. So, of course, if you've got any heart problems, you shouldn't go near it. It is not known if Viagra caused these problems, and presumably they're not going to bother to investigate that. Tell your healthcare provider if you have any side effects that bother you or don't go away. So isn't this pretty typical of Big Pharma? Huge profits it thinks can be made. So free advertising effectively in British mainstream papers. Don't worry about the side effects. If you lose your sight or hearing, it's not really a problem. Enjoy yourself. And we'll end on this one, which we were kindly sent a few days ago. Just fascinating. The Plymouth Herald, the Plymouth local newspaper, has been doing some proper investigative journalism. And they've discovered that Plymouth City Council has been setting up a property empire, £130 million worth of property being sucked into this council-run empire. They say they're doing it in order to offset cost cutting and lack of funding from government. But what's actually being built is a property empire, which means that if you live in Plymouth, the local authority controls everything. It controls the lease on the property, it controls the rent levels, it controls tax and any council tax that you're going to pay. And they've even been buying up public property, which is fascinating because one would have thought their job was to administer the public property for the public in the right place. And the caption, rightly or wrongly, I picked up from the article itself because it seemed that the journalist who wrote it was beginning to think, is this right? So the statement used was, rightly or wrongly, Plymouth City Council are buying up all this property. And of course, we can combine that with the huge unusable reserves, which we know that councils across the country have. And I understand, Mike, that information you've received on that is saying that the official answer is we need these reserves for our pension pots.
That's right.
Okay, we'll leave it there. And we'll say thank you very much to those who are subscribing to the UK column. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider doing that, because we can only do what we do with your financial support. Thanks very much for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.